You carry more as a teammate than a friend.
Apparently they were close. That makes yet another loss in your daughter's life.
Then where do we go from here?
Wayne asked.
I'm going to keep in close touch with Valerie and her teachers.
I'll monitor her progress and we'll keep both of you informed.
Of course, if you notice any changes, let me know.
As the Longs left the office, Aline was more concerned than ever about Valerie.
52.
Father Frank knew that he must try to persuade Marge to share with the police what Jamie had told her. He understood Marge's horror that the police might focus on Jamie as the killer. But it was not fair to have Alan on the verge of suicide when there was a witness who could exonerate him. Father Frank had replayed the two conversations with Marge a dozen times in his mind. She had confided in him, which is very different from being in the state of sacrament. If she had asked him to hear her confession, his obligation to remain silent would have been absolute. But since she had merely confided in him, the sacrament of penance did not apply. If Marge would not do so, it was his obligation to share what he knew with the police. After her conversation with Father Frank, Marge's conscience continued to weigh heavily on her. She had asked Jamie twice over the past 2 days to repeat what he saw happen in Carrie's yard before he went swimming with her. Both times he told the same story.
Alan kissed Carrie goodbye. Then he went home. Then the big guy hit Carrie and pushed her into the pool.
He added,
Daddy called me the big guy. He's in heaven with Carrie.
The idea that Alan was going through a living hell for something he didn't do gnawed at Marge. That was why when she called Father Frank and he said he could come over, it was a relief. She had decided to discuss with him how to go about contacting the police. The doorbell rang at 3:30. Jamie had gone straight from work to watch the school teams practice. Marge was relieved that he would not be home when she spoke to Father Frank. When she answered the bell, Father Frank followed her into the modest living room, which was scrupulously neat. She invited him to sit down and pointed at a large, overstuffed chair that reminded him of the furniture in his grandmother's house.
That was Jack's favorite chair, Marge said. After his grandmother died, Jack brought it home.
It's very comfortable, Marge.
I'm sorry, Father. I'm talking about furniture because I'm too nervous to talk about the reason I asked you to come over.
Marge, I was planning to call you. I think I know what you want to talk about.
It's not right for me to keep quiet while Alan Crowley is in so much trouble.
Father Frank remained silent to allow her to continue. Marge bit her lip.
Since I spoke to you, I have asked Jamie twice to tell me what he saw the night of Carrie's party. Both times he repeated that Alan kissed Carrie and then went home.
She looked away as though gathering strength.
I know in my heart of hearts Jamie never would have hurt Carrie. I have to tell the police what I know.
Marge, you are making the right decision.
Father Frank tried to conceal the relief he felt that Marge had reached that conclusion on her own.
Father, I don't have any money. Obviously, neither does Jamie. I understand there are lawyers that will help people like us for free.
Do you mean public defenders?
Yes, if that's what they call them. I'd like to speak to one now before I talk to the police about Jamie.
Marge, from what I understand, it doesn't work that way. They will make a public defender available to someone who has been accused of something. I don't think they can help you before then.
I have $10,000 in my savings account. Will that be enough for a lawyer?
Marge, I don't know a lot about how much lawyers charge. I do know that one of our parishioners, Greg Barber, is a very good attorney. For much less than his usual fee, he has worked with our parishioners who needed his help. If you would like, I'll reach out to him for you.
I would appreciate it so much.
I'll speak to him this evening. I know he'll want to help you.
That evening, Father Frank phoned Greg's home. Greg's wife told him he was finishing a case in Atlanta and would return in 4 days. She gave Father Frank his cell phone number. Father Frank immediately called Greg, who promised that he would try to help Marge, and asked that she call his office the day he got back. Father Frank called Marge and told her about the lawyer's schedule. They both agreed that she should wait to speak to him before contacting the police. He would remain in touch with Alan Crowley to make sure he was all right. Hopefully, a few more days would not make any difference. The seminar, as promised, concluded promptly at 8:30. Aline was happy she had decided to go. The presenters had offered interesting insights about how some student-athletes turn sports, which should be a stress reliever, into an additional source of stress. The problem was often made worse by parents and coaches who focused solely on winning. The small auditorium appeared to be about half filled. As she was standing up to leave, Aline looked around. She was relieved when she did not recognize anyone she knew. As they started to walk outside, Scott said,
"Now for the $64,000 question."
His hands pretended to do a drum roll.
"I know a wonderful Italian restaurant nearby, and I promise I won't practice my fractured French on you."
"I enjoyed brushing up on my French."
She followed him to a restaurant that was less than a mile away and pulled up next to him in the parking lot. When she got out of her car, he was holding up a wine carrier with two bottles.
"It's a bring-your-own restaurant. I brought a Chardonnay and a Pinot Noir, just in case you said yes."
Once inside, Scott ordered from the menu in surprisingly good Italian.
"You didn't tell me you know Italian as well."
"My grandmother was from Italy. She loved to talk to me in Italian. Fortunately, I remember most of it."
"You are a man of many hidden talents," Aline said, smiling.
"My mother would often say that to me. And then my aunt would always chime in, 'If you're so damn smart, why ain't you rich?'"
The calamari and the veal were excellent. Their conversation glided easily from politics to favorite movies. When they were finishing their cappuccinos, Aline brought up a topic that had been in the back of her mind all evening.
"Scott, I've been meaning to ask you about a student I'm really concerned about. I'm sure you know her because she played varsity lacrosse."
"Who are you worried about?"
"Valerie Long, the girl who transferred to Saddle River last January. I met with her parents today."
"It sounds serious. What's wrong?"
"She appears to be withdrawn and depressed. One of her teachers has already spoken to me about her appearing distracted."
"I'm so sorry to hear this."
"The reason I bring it up is, as her coach, you got to work closely with Valerie last spring. Is she in any of your math classes?"
"No, not this year."
"What was your impression of her when you coached her?"
"Frankly, she's a kid with two personalities. On the sidelines, she is shy, often standing someplace off by herself. Put her in the game, and she goes into attack mode. She's the most aggressive player on the field. But when the game's over, it's back to quiet and timid. She was the only sophomore on the varsity squad. I know Carrie tried particularly hard to make her feel included."
"Was Valerie close to any of the other girls?"
"Not really. I tried to be, what's the word, available to her, but she kept me at a distance as well."
"Do you see her often in school now?"
"Lacrosse isn't until the spring, so I don't see her every day like I used to. We'll pass in the hallway and say hi to each other. Nothing really beyond that."
"Okay. I'm just trying to figure out a way to get through to her."
"I'll try to help. Engage her in conversation. Maybe she'll open up to one of us."
"Thanks. And thank you again for dinner."
54. As Nancy Carter glanced out her kitchen window, she found it hard to believe how quickly the last 2 weeks had flown by. She and her husband Carl had agreed that he would take their son Tony to Alaska on a fishing trip. It would be a break in every sense of the word. Workaholic Carl would see that his partners at his civil engineering firm were perfectly capable of running the business while he was away. Tony would break his habit of constantly being on social media by leaving his cell phone home. Carl had brought his phone with the understanding that Nancy would contact them only in the event of a dire emergency. And, she admitted to herself, although she dearly loved her husband, it was a nice break for her. but in the 2 weeks they were away, Nancy wondered if she should have let Tony know that Carrie Dowling had been murdered. Tony had gone to Saddle River High School for 2 years and was about to start at Choate, the famous boarding school in Connecticut, where he would do his junior and senior year. He and Carrie had known each other from the time they had been in student government together. Nancy knew he would be very sad to hear of her death and learn that he had missed her wake and funeral. That was precisely why she had decided not to tell him about what had happened to her while he was away. She had checked the United Airline app. Their flight had landed in Newark on time. The sound of car doors opening and closing in the driveway announced their arrival. After hugs all around and carrying in their gear, they sat at the kitchen table. Carl introduced the conversation Nancy had been so concerned about.
"So, did we miss anything while we were away?"
Looking at Tony, she said, "I'm sorry to say, yes. Something terrible happened while you were away." She told them about Carrie's tragic death and the police investigation. Tony immediately grabbed his cell phone off the charger and reviewed the messages his friends had sent him about Carrie. They repeated the same information. Carrie had a party on Saturday night. Her father and sister found her dead in the pool around noon on Sunday. Carrie and Alan had a fight at the party.
"We were away for 2 weeks," Carl said. "When did this happen?"
"I heard about it on the radio, literally while you were on your way to the airport to start your trip. Then Alan was arrested. From what I've read in the papers and seen on the news, the police believe Alan went back after the party was over and killed Carrie."
"So, Mom, they found her in the pool Sunday morning around the time Dad and the limo picked me up at the Acme?"
Tony asked. "That's right, Tony. And I hope you'll understand why I didn't..." Waving her off, Tony said,
"No, Mom, that's okay. Did the papers say anything about Jamie Chapman?"
"Jamie Chapman?" Nancy said incredulously. "No. Why would they?"
"That was the Sunday Dad and I left on the trip, right?"
"Yes," Nancy answered. "Dad left here in the limo and picked you up at Acme, and you went straight to the airport." What he was trying to remember came back to Tony.
"I noticed Jamie's sneakers," he said.
Then he blurted out,
"He had new sneakers. He was showing them off to everyone. I know he was wearing them on Saturday because he asked me a bunch of times if I liked them. But he wasn't wearing them on that Sunday. The ones he had on were all scuffed up. I asked him why he changed them. He said they got wet because he was swimming in the pool with Carrie after her party."
His mother and father stared at him.
"After her party?"
they both said in unison.
"Are you sure that's what Jamie told you?"
his father asked.
"Dad, I'm positive."
Walking over to the phone, Carl said,
"Tony, you have to tell the police what you just told us."
He began dialing the number of the Saddle River Police Department. They took Carl's name and phone number and said they would immediately notify Detective Wilson of his call. Marina Long and her husband Wayne had been concerned about Valerie ever since they moved from Chicago to Saddle River. They understood that it had been an abrupt and dramatic change for her, but had hoped and expected that her new school, which was highly rated, would bring her around. At her previous school, even though she was innately shy, she'd had many close friends. They had now been in New Jersey for 9 months. That should have been enough time to make new friends. "But where are they?" Marina asked herself. "Valerie always seems to be alone." Marina had taken the afternoon off. She had hoped to spend some time with her daughter. But when Valerie came home from school, she went straight to her room and closed the door behind her. When Marina called her for dinner shortly after Wayne got home, she was her usual distant self. They both tried to initiate a conversation by asking about the outlook for this year's lacrosse team. Her one-word answer was,
"Good."
It was over coffee and Valerie's favorite apple pie dessert that Marina broached the subject with her.
"Valerie, Miss Dowling called and asked us to meet with her. We went over to the school this morning."
Valerie half closed her eyes as though in denial.
She had no right to do that, she said fiercely.
She had every right, Marina said. Apparently the teachers are worried about the way you are in class.
What's wrong with the way I am in class?
Valerie asked defensively.
You appear to be distracted, and your marks went downhill shortly after we moved here.
They'll go back up, Valerie said.
Is there any reason why your marks changed? Wayne said gently.
When she did not answer, he said,
Look, Valerie, I think you have resented my presence since your mother and I got together. Let's see if we can clear the air right now. My first wife and I always hoped to have a daughter. Of course, that didn't happen, and Lucy died around the same time as your father. I know what it's like to lose someone you're very close to. When you lost your dad, you were heartbroken. I know I can't replace him, and I don't want to. But I want you to know that I want to be close to you. I consider you the daughter I never had.
Valerie looked away.
Val, we know that the move was abrupt, Marina said. And I told you that Wayne had gotten a big promotion. That was absolutely true. But the fact is that the Chicago office where he worked was being closed, and if he didn't accept the offer in New York, he would have been out of work.
Valerie did not answer. Marina looked at her and said,
Valerie, your father loved you very much. I'm sure that it's a great comfort to Daddy to know that Wayne is here for you, and he loves you.
Valerie considered telling her what was really happening, but her lips would not form the words. She had told Carrie, the only person she felt she could confide in, and Carrie was dead. She shook her head, as though dismissing what her mother and stepfather had told her. She pushed back her chair and abruptly left the table. Marina followed her up the stairs.
Valerie, something is upsetting you that you won't talk about, but you can't live with it. You've lost Daddy and your grandmother. I think what you need to do is speak to a therapist, someone who can help you.
Do me a favor, Mom. Leave me alone,
Valerie said, as she shut the door to her room. 56. As he drove to the Chapman home, Mike was still trying to process the ramifications of the meeting he had that morning with Tony Carter and his father.
Jamie Chapman said he went swimming with Carrie after her party.
Tony was absolutely certain about his recollection of what Jamie had told him. The impact on the investigation could not be underestimated. Mike had tried to impress on Tony and his parents that they should not share Tony's information about Jamie. But he was concerned. He got the impression that they were talkers. Carrie's body had been discovered by her family at 11:15 a.m. that Sunday morning. The forensic report from the medical examiner could provide only a rough estimate of how long she had been in the water. Carrie had sent a text at 11:10 p.m. telling Alan not to come over to her house. Assuming she was the one who sent the text, and Mike had no reason to believe otherwise, that was the latest time he could document that she was alive. Alan's three friends and the waitress at Nellie's confirmed that Alan left Nellie's at approximately 11:15. The 3.9-mile drive from Nellie's to the Dowling home would have taken Alan about 11 minutes. Was it possible that Jamie went swimming with Carrie after 11 o'clock when the party ended, but before Alan returned to the house? Very unlikely. He had brought fellow detective Andy Nerlino with him because he wanted to question Marge and Jamie out of each other's presence.
I interviewed them the day the body was discovered, Mike told him. My last thought when I left the house was that their answers sounded rehearsed.
Understood.
When they reached the Chapman home, Mike rang the front doorbell. There was no answer. They walked around the house to see if the Chapmans were in the backyard. When they were not there, Andy walked over to the back door and knocked on it. Then he said,
Mike, come over here and take a look at this.
He was pointing at a small smudge stain on the white wooden door, just below the handle.
Blood?
Mike asked as he leaned in closer for a look.
It might be, Andy said.
Mike took out his cell phone and snapped several pictures of the stain, then dialed his office.
I need an evidence tech right away, he said crisply.
20 minutes later, the tech arrived. He removed a portion of the stain and placed it in an evidence bag. Mike and Andy agreed that it was just as well the Chapmans weren't home.
We need to know if this stain is blood, and whose it is before we talk to them,
Mike said.
We'll ask for a rush at the lab, but even then it will take a few days to get the results. I'm going to call the Carters again, and emphasize how absolutely important it is that they keep their mouths shut.
57. The police had insisted Tony Carter say nothing about his statement to them. For a few days, he managed to comply. But when word got back to the Carters that someone reported seeing police cars at Marge Chapman's home, he couldn't help himself. His mother and father were no better at staying silent. Tony's story,
I helped solve Carrie's murder. Alan Crowley is innocent. Jamie Chapman was the last one to be with Carrie when she was alive,
spread through the town like wildfire. Instead of being elated, Alan's reaction surprised his parents.
The police have this all screwed up, he said matter-of-factly. I saw Carrie and Jamie together lots of times. There's no way he killed her any more than I did.
I can't believe you're not excited and thrilled, June snapped. I think we should call Princeton right now.
Mom, don't get too excited about the stuff on Jamie. I'm telling you, they're wrong. When they figure that out, guess who they're going to come back to, he said while pointing at his chest.
Annoyed at her son's reaction to the stunning news, June stormed out of the room and went upstairs. Her tone of voice exultant, she called Lester Parker and told him about Tony Carter.
Parker said, June, I was just going to call you. I have just heard the rumor that a neighbor might have been in the pool with Carrie after the party, but let's not go too fast on this one. My understanding is that the young man who claims he was in the pool with her has a substantial intellectual disability. The police might conclude that his story is a fantasy or a fabrication, or just not something they can rely on.
When June hung up the phone, she felt deflated, but at the same time, more optimistic. Despite Lester Parker's caution, Alan had to realize that the police were looking at another suspect. She was hoping this would lift his mood enough to keep at bay any more thoughts of harming himself. 58. It was lunchtime when several students came over to Aline and excitedly told her about Tony Carter going to the police. Her instinctive reaction was that Jamie would never hurt Carrie. She had started babysitting for him when he was 8 years old. Carrie was 6 at the time. She would often bring Carrie along when she sat at Jamie's house, or, in swimming weather, would bring Jamie to her house. He was always so gentle in every way, she thought. He loved Carrie so much. She went directly home after school. The front door was unlocked.
Mom?
Aline called as she walked in.
Out here,
was her mother's response from the patio and back. Fran was sitting on one of the lounge chairs near where Steve had laid down Carrie's lifeless body after he carried her out of the pool. Aline wondered how often her mother sat there and why she would have chosen that spot. Fran's first words were,
By now I assume you have heard about Tony Carter. I wonder how much the Crowleys paid the Carters to have Tony spread that story. It's disgusting that they would try to place the blame on someone like Jamie who can't even defend himself.
Mom, why would the Carters do that?
I'll tell you why. It's because they're social climbers. I myself have heard June Crowley say that Carl Carter is always pestering Doug to sponsor him to join Ridgewood Country Club. What a trade-off to blame poor innocent Jamie for a crime their son committed.
Mom, you know how much I care about Jamie, Aline protested. But I simply cannot believe that the Crowleys got Tony Carter to lie for them.
You've been defending Alan from day one. I don't understand you. Mom, you tried and convicted Alan on day one. I don't understand you.
Then we agree to disagree, Fran said firmly.
Look, Mom, the last thing I want to do is to have us getting upset with each other.
And I can tell you this. Remember Mike Wilson asked you and Dad about whether you knew about the flat tire Carrie had?
Yes, and she hadn't told us about it because Dad had been after her to pick up a new tire.
The police still haven't found the tow truck driver who fixed the flat and wanted to come to the house after everyone had left the party. Alan has been arrested, but I know that Mike won't be satisfied until they locate this guy and find out where he was the night of the party.
So what's your point? Fran asked.
My point is that 24 hours ago, we didn't know about Jamie supposedly swimming with Carrie the night of the party. We both are certain he had nothing to do with what happened to Carrie. The police still haven't found the tow truck driver. My point is there's still a lot we don't know. Let's try to reserve judgment.
Okay. Enough on this topic for now. Let's have a glass of wine.
When they were in the living room sipping their wine, Fran said,
You told us you were going to a seminar with Scott Kimball and that you might have dinner with him. You got home pretty late, so I'm assuming you went to dinner. How was it?
The seminar or the dinner? Aline asked with a smile.
Fran managed to laugh. Seminars are all the same. Tell me about the dinner.
It was actually very nice. It was an Italian restaurant. The food was delicious. I had...
Her mother cut her off. I want to hear about Scott Kimball.
Mom, why am I not surprised?
I like Scott. He's a very nice guy, and good-looking as well.
He's intelligent and easy to talk to.
But as she was speaking, the memory of sitting across the table from Mike Wilson came to mind. I so much more enjoyed his company, she thought. But now is not the time to say that.
Fran said, Honey, this is very tough for all of us. But if you have a chance to have an enjoyable evening, I want you to take it. Dad and I are finalizing plans to go to Bermuda for a long weekend. A change of scenery will do us both good.
I agree. That will be great for both of you.
Mike reviewed the lab report regarding the analysis of the stain the tech had lifted from the back door of the Chapman home. It was blood. The sample had then been compared to Carrie's DNA and produced a match. It was definitely Carrie's blood. Armed with Tony Carter's statement that Jamie had told him he had gone swimming with Carrie after her party, and having found Carrie's blood on the back door of the Chapman home, Mike applied for a search warrant. It was granted immediately. The day had become overcast. The breeze was unusually cool for a September morning. Mike, who loved to go golfing, hoped that this would not be an indication of an early onset of cold weather. With Andy Nerlino at his side and the search warrant in hand, he rang the front doorbell of the Chapman home. Almost immediately, it was answered. Marge was wearing an apron over a pair of old slacks with bleach marks. She looked startled to see them.
Mrs. Chapman, you might remember me. My name is Mike Wilson. I'm a detective with the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office. This is my colleague, Detective Andy Nerlino.
Of course I remember you. I'm embarrassed. I'm dressed to clean my house. I didn't know you were coming.
It's all right, Mrs. Chapman, Mike said. You're absolutely fine the way you are. I must inform you that we have obtained a warrant from a judge to search your home. Here's your copy.
Stunned as she looked down at the document, Marge said,
I don't get it. Why on earth would you want to search my home?
Mike replied,
It's in connection with our investigation of Carrie Dowling's murder. And while we're here, we want to speak to both you and your son, Jamie. Is he home?
Her mouth dry, Marge said,
He's upstairs in his room watching TV.
Detective Nerlino will stay with you here. I'm going upstairs to speak to Jamie.
Oh, no, Marge said. Jamie might get upset. I think I should be with him when he speaks to you.
Your son Jamie is 20 years old. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Then he is legally an adult. I'm going to talk to him alone, Mike said as he headed toward the stairs.
Marge reached out her hand as if to stop him. Then she sighed nervously and walked to the couch. The vacuum cleaner was on the rug. Her foot brushed against it as she sat down. There was a dust cloth and furniture polish on the table.
Almost unconsciously, she picked them up and put them down next to the vacuum.
You remind me of my mother, Andy said. She goes through the house once a week. There isn't a spot left in it when she's finished. I can tell you're like her.
Marge moistened her lips.
I guess I am. I want to go upstairs and be with Jamie.
In a little while, Detective Wilson will be finished. I'm sorry, but I have to insist that you stay here.
Mike knocked on Jamie's half-closed door. As he pushed it open, he said,
Hi, Jamie. I'm Mike Wilson. Do you remember me?
Jamie was sprawled across his bed. The movie Ace Ventura, Pet Detective was playing in the background.
You work in Hackensack, Jamie said proudly. That's right, Jamie. I'm a detective. My office is in Hackensack. Would it be okay if the TV is off when we're talking? Sure. It's a tape. I can watch it whenever I want, Jamie said as he got up and hit the power button on the TV.
He went back to his bed and sat on it.
I like watching movies, Mike said. Do you? Yes. Mom buys tapes and DVDs for my birthday. Your mom is very nice. She loves me, and I love her. Jamie, do you remember the last time I came and talked to you in your room?
Jamie nodded.
You told me Carrie had gone to heaven. She's there with my dad. And I told you that the police and Carrie's parents are trying to find out what happened to Carrie before she went to heaven. I remember. That's great, Jamie. I'll bet you're really good at remembering things.
Jamie smiled.
I want you to remember the night Carrie had her party, the night she went to heaven. I asked if you had seen Carrie in her backyard cleaning up after the party. You know what you told me?
Mike took out his small notebook and read.
You said, I did not go swimming with Carrie. I'm not allowed to talk about this, Jamie said, looking down and avoiding eye contact with Mike. Why not, Jamie?
When he didn't answer, Mike asked,
Who told you you can't talk about this? My mom said it's a secret. You're not supposed to tell secrets.
Mike paused for a moment.
Jamie, your mom said it was okay for me to come up to your room and talk to you. Do you know what else she said? No, he answered as he shook his head. She said, it's okay for you to tell me the secret. She even told me part of the secret. She said the night of Carrie's party, you didn't stay in your room. You went outside. She said you can tell me the rest of the secret. Okay, Jamie said softly. Carrie lets me go swimming with her. She went swimming after her party. I wanted to go swimming, so I went over to her house. Was Carrie in her pool when you went over? Yes. Did you talk to Carrie when you went over? Yes. What did you say? I said, Carrie, it's Jamie. Let's go swimming.
Jamie, try to remember. This is important.
Did Carrie answer you? She said, I can't. Carrie told you I can't go swimming? She was sleeping in the water. Jamie, did you go in the water with Carrie?
Jamie started to tear up.
I got my new sneakers and my pants wet. Did you touch Carrie when she was in the pool?
Jamie held his hand in the air as if shaking someone.
I said, Carrie, wake up! Wake up! What did Carrie say? She was still sleeping in the water. Jamie, you're doing a really good job at remembering. I have a few more questions. So Carrie kept sleeping in the pool. What did you do then? My sneakers and pants were all wet. I came home and went up to my room. Where was your mom when you came home? She was sleeping in her chair. Where is her chair? In the living room. Did you talk to your mom? No, she was sleeping. Okay. What did you do when you went to your room?
I took off my sneakers and socks and pants. I hid them on the floor of my closet.
Why did you hide them?
Because they were all wet. My sneakers are new. I'm not supposed to get them wet.
Mike stopped for a moment. The information provided by Tony Carter appears to be accurate.
Jamie, do you know what a golf club is?
Mr. Dowling has one.
The night you went swimming with Carrie after the party, did you see a golf club?
I put it on the chair.
Jamie,
Mike said while glancing down at his notebook.
When I came to see you last time, you said you weren't invited to the party. You were older. It was only for the high school kids. Do you remember that?
Yes,
he said while looking down.
When people don't get invited to parties, sometimes they get angry. Were you mad at Carrie when she didn't invite you?
I'm her friend.
I know that, Jamie.
And sometimes friends can hurt our feelings.
When she didn't invite you, were you mad at Carrie?
I was sad.
What do you do when you're sad?
I go to my room and watch tapes and DVDs.
Mike decided to change course.
Jamie, do you know Alan Crowley?
My mom and I saw him on TV. He kissed Carrie and went home.
Then what happened, Jamie?
Big Guy hit her and pushed her in the pool.
Do you know who Big Guy is?
Jamie smiled broadly.
My dad called me Big Guy.
Jamie, did you hit Carrie?
No.
Did you push her in the pool?
No. Big Guy did.
Jamie, are you Big Guy?
Yes.
Are you the big guy who hit Carrie and pushed her in the pool?
I'm Big Guy. Big Guy hit Carrie and pushed her in the pool.
Jamie, you're a big guy. Is there anybody else who's a big guy?
There were footsteps on the stairs.
Marge pushed open the door and came in with Nerlino trailing behind her.
You have no right to keep me away from my son, she said.
She went over and sat beside Jamie.
Are you all right, dear?
I told him the secret. You said it was all right.
Marge's glare at Mike Wilson was steely.
Mike stood up. Mrs. Chapman, as I told you earlier, we have a warrant to search these premises.
He looked at Jamie's feet.
Are those your new sneakers, Jamie?
Yes. Do you like them?
Yes, I do. I'm going to need to borrow them for a few days.
That's okay, Jamie said.
While looking at his mother for approval, he removed his sneakers.
Jamie, do you remember what clothes you were wearing the night you went swimming with Carrie after her party?
Yes, I do. My mom bought the shirt for me.
Can I see it?
Sure,
Jamie said as he walked over to the dresser and opened and closed two drawers.
Mom bought it in Disney World,
he said proudly as he unfolded it and showed it to the detective.
Do you remember which pants you wore when you went in the pool with Carrie?
Jamie appeared confused as he looked in his closet.
I have a lot of pants.
That's okay, Jamie. So that's the shirt you wore in the pool when you went swimming with Carrie?
Yes,
he said, smiling.
It's dry now.
Did you wash it, Jamie?
No, my mom did.
Tony Carter had said that on the Sunday morning he and Jamie talked at the Acme, Jamie had told him that he wasn't wearing his new sneakers because they had gotten wet.
Jamie, this is Detective Nerlino. Would you bring the shirt and sneakers downstairs? He's going to give you a bag to put them in.
Okay,
Jamie said as he followed Nerlino out of the room. When they were alone, Marge went on the defensive.
You can ask Father Frank. I was planning to call the police and tell them what Jamie saw. The lawyer Father Frank got for Jamie and me is in Atlanta. I was going to talk to you after I spoke to him in 2 days. Father Frank is going with me to see the lawyer. Then we can talk.
Mrs. Chapman, let me be clear. Are you saying that you and Jamie have an attorney?
Yes, we have one.
It's your right to have one.
I want to talk to him before Jamie or I talk any more to you.
Okay. There will be no more questions today, but we will be executing the search warrant.
Jamie yelled from downstairs.
It was okay to tell them our secret, right, Mom?
Yes, Jamie. It was all right,
Marge called back. Her tone was weary, and she was short of breath as she came down the stairs. The phone rang. It was Father Frank.
Marge, I'm just calling to check in and make sure you are okay.
For Marge, the 2 days before attorney Greg Barber returned from Atlanta were interminable. She had told Father Frank that Detective Wilson had insisted on talking to Jamie without her being in the room.
I don't know what Jamie told him or how the detective could have twisted it, she said, but I'm so frightened.
Marge, the appointment with Greg Barber is the day after tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I'll pick you up at 9:30 and we'll ride over together. Greg is a top-drawer defense lawyer, I can assure you of that. I know you'll feel better after you speak to him.
Jamie intuitively knew she was upset. 3 or 4 times he asked her,
Mom, are you mad at me because I told our secret? Mike said it was all right.
I'm not angry at you, Jamie,
Marge repeated each time. When he asked her that, it reminded her of how trusting he always is, and how easily he could be led when questioned. As he had promised, Father Frank picked her up promptly at 9:30.
Greg Barber's office is around the corner from the courthouse, he explained.
When they passed the courthouse, Marge looked at it and cringed. This was where they brought Alan Crowley, she thought. She recalled seeing the pictures of him on television in the orange jumpsuit. She imagined Jamie wearing it and couldn't bear the possibility. They arrived 10 minutes early, but the receptionist brought them immediately into Greg Barber's private office. Marge liked his appearance. He was about 50 years old with thinning gray hair. His horn-rimmed glasses made him look more like a schoolteacher. He walked out from behind his desk to greet them and motioned them to a small conference table. After they sat down, Barber came directly to the point.
Mrs. Chapman, Father Frank gave me some information about your son. I understand he has special needs, an intellectual disability.
Marge nodded, then burst out.
Father Frank and I were planning to go with you to the police and tell them what Jamie saw, but then that blabbermouth Tony Carter started bragging about the fact that he had solved the murder, that my Jamie had killed Carrie Dowling. Because of that, the detective came to our house and insisted on talking to Jamie in his room upstairs while I was downstairs. God only knows what he tricked Jamie into saying.
Mrs. Chapman, I'm sure you've heard of the Miranda warnings. Did the detective ever tell you or Jamie that you didn't have to speak to him?
I don't remember him saying anything about that. I have no idea what he said to Jamie upstairs.
How old is Jamie?
He's 20.
Did Jamie go to school?
Oh, yes. He went to the local high school, Saddle River. He was in special classes the 4 years he was there.
What is the nature of his disability?
When he was born, it was a difficult delivery. He was deprived of oxygen. The doctors told us he has brain damage.
Jamie lives with you now?
Of course. He couldn't be on his own.
Jamie's father?
He died when Jamie was 15.
Does Jamie work?
Yes, he bags groceries 5 days a week, 4 hours a day at the local Acme. That's where he told Tony Carter that he went swimming with Carrie the night of her party.
Mrs. Chapman, parents of children who have intellectual disabilities often make a decision around the time the child turns 18. To protect the child, they apply for a guardianship which makes their child, in the eyes of the law, a permanent child. Did you do this on Jamie's behalf?
At school, they suggested I apply for a guardianship. I did.
So you went to the courthouse, appeared in front of a judge, and he granted a full guardianship? You make all decisions for him?
Yes. It was a few months after his 18th birthday.
Good. Do you know where your guardianship papers are?
I have them at home in the top drawer of my dresser.
Father Frank said,
Marge, give them to me when I drop you off.
Why do you want them?
She asked Barber.
because I want to determine whether the detective had a right to question Jamie outside your presence and without your permission. Beyond that, even though Jamie wasn't under arrest or in police custody, I think I can make a strong argument that since he was a suspect, he didn't have to speak to the detective. But that's for later. Now let's start from the beginning, with the night your neighbor had a party and the young girl was murdered. Tell me everything you recall about that night and the following morning, right up until when the detectives came to your house last week.
Step by step, Marge related everything that had happened. Finding Jamie's wet clothes and sneakers in his closet. Seeing Steve Dowling carry Carrie's body out of the pool. In a panic, washing the clothes and sneakers. Making Jamie swear that he wouldn't tell anyone about going in the pool that night. She told Greg Barber about Jamie telling her that he had seen Alan talking to Carrie and then leaving. And her concern about Jamie saying that the big guy hit Carrie and pushed her in the pool, and that she had felt guilty ever since Alan Crowley was arrested. She finished by saying,
"Father Frank will back me up on this. I was planning to go to the police, but I wanted to speak to you first. But then that Tony Carter told everyone that he had solved Carrie's murder and that Jamie did it."
"Mrs. Chapman, there are some circumstances in which I would be concerned that two family members whom the police are scrutinizing should have separate lawyers. I think, however, that for the time being, I can be the attorney for both you and Jamie. Do you have any issue with that?"
"Oh, no, Mr. Barber. I know you'll do your best for both of us, but it is Jamie that I am worried about."
"All right, fine. We'll work out the financial details later. For now, leave it in my hands."
Barber turned to Father Frank.
"Father, when you drop Mrs. Chapman off, would you please leave those guardianship papers in my home mailbox?"
"Of course,"
Father Frank said.
"Mrs. Chapman, I cannot stress strongly enough what I'm about to tell you. If anyone contacts you or Jamie wanting to talk about this case, do not say anything. Just give them my name and phone number and tell them to contact me."
"Mr. Barber..."
"Please call me Greg."
"Greg, I'm so relieved and grateful. Please call me Marge."
He smiled.
"Marge, Father Frank speaks very highly of you and your son. We will get through this. I want you to come back tomorrow at 1 p.m. with Jamie. I need to go through everything with him."
"61. After her conversation with Fran, Aline was troubled. She had to speak to Mike Wilson about Jamie, but she knew it would not be a short conversation. He answered on the first ring.
"Mike, it's Aline Dowling. I have some information I want to share with you. By any chance, are you free for dinner tonight?"
"Yes, I am,"
was his immediate response.
"Do you know Estee Street, the restaurant in Park Ridge?"
"Sure. I love their food."
7 o'clock tonight?"
"We're on."
For the rest of the afternoon, Aline had a sense of relief. She knew Mike Wilson was determined to find Carrie's killer, but he didn't know Jamie the way she did. When she arrived at the restaurant, Mike was already there. He waved to her from a table in the corner. She slid into her chair and saw a white wine waiting for her. This time there was a white wine in front of Mike as well.
"Tonight I'm joining you,"
he said.
"If I ever needed a glass of wine, it's now," Aline told him.
"Then I'm glad you didn't have to wait for it. By the way, how are your folks doing?"
"They're doing a little better. They're planning a long weekend in Bermuda."
"Glad to hear that. They've been through a lot."
The waiter came over with menus.
"Let's take a look and get our order in before it gets crowded."
He could sense the tension in Aline. Her eyes looked strained, and he realized that in the last few weeks she had lost some weight. Mike said,
"Aline, I asked how your parents are doing. I neglected to ask how you're doing."
"Frankly, Mike, I just can't believe what's going on. I'll be the first to admit I don't know Alan Crowley very well. Most of the time Carrie went out with him, I was in London. I met him a few times when I was home for a holiday. But whenever Carrie mentioned him in emails to me, it seemed obvious that she and Alan cared deeply about each other. I know they had that spat at the party, but there's a big difference between being upset with each other and killing somebody. You certainly know that Tony Carter is telling everybody that Jamie killed Carrie. It drives me crazy to hear that. I started babysitting Jamie when he was 8 years old. I can tell you right now that there's no way in the world that he ever would hurt Carrie. Quite simply, he loved her.
Aline, you just admitted to me that you don't really know Alan Crowley that well because you were away during the time Carrie was dating him. Let me remind you, you were also away from Jamie those 3 years. That sweet young boy you babysat for is now a young man. People change over time. That may be the case with Jamie.
Mike, people don't change that much. I would swear on a stack of Bibles that Jamie is incapable of hurting anyone, especially Carrie.
Aline, I'm going to share something with you that I really shouldn't. I want your assurance that this conversation stays at this table.
Aline nodded.
I went to the Chapman home the other day and talked to Jamie. My office is currently processing several pieces of potential evidence. We'll know a lot more when we get the results.
Aline knew she had to be satisfied with that. Just to let you know, Mike, she said, my mother agrees with me that Jamie would never hurt Carrie. And she saw Jamie all the time in the 3 years I was gone.
Aline, I want to find out what happened to Carrie. I'm going to pursue every lead to its conclusion.
He decided to change the subject.
What's new at school?
The usual. Right now the seniors are under the gun to finish their college application essays. I'm spending a lot of time working on them. As you can imagine, some of them are so torn between what schools to apply to.
I'm not surprised. This is the first really important decision they're making in their lives.
I do have one student I'm worried about. She started at the school in January after moving here from Chicago. For no apparent reason, her marks have gone down. She's very withdrawn. Her parents are worried sick.
Do you think drugs are involved?
No, I don't. But I can sense she's holding something back. I just don't know what it can be.
Does she have any friends at school?
Even though she's 2 years younger, she was very close to Carrie when they played lacrosse last spring. I'm told that Carrie was her confidant on the team. And now she misses her very much.
Are you worried she might hurt herself?
Yes. And so are her parents. They tried to get her to see a therapist. She refused.
Typical, unfortunately. I really hope the problem is homesickness, and with time she'll get over it.
Their orders came, and Mike was happy that as the meal went on, Aline's spirits brightened considerably. Mike walked her to her car and opened the door for her. It was an effort to resist the urge to put his arm around her. 62. On Saturday morning, when the doorbell rang at Marge's home, she was surprised to see Mike Wilson.
Mrs. Chapman, I have applied for permission to take Jamie's fingerprints. You and Jamie have the right to appear with your lawyer in court. A hearing is scheduled for Monday morning at 10 o'clock, and then the judge will make his decision. Here is your copy of the paperwork.
Visibly flustered, Marge said, Our lawyer is Greg Barber in Hackensack. He's very smart. I'm going to call him right now.
Okay, here's my card. If Mr. Barber wants to contact me before the hearing, he can do so.
As she watched Wilson drive away, Marge was already dialing Greg Barber's number. His secretary connected them, and Marge read the document she had been given.
Marge, let's stay calm. I'm not surprised by this. Even though Jamie is not under arrest, the judge can order that he submit to fingerprinting. I'll go to court with you and Jamie tomorrow. I'll object, but I'm pretty sure the judge will order it. And since we'll be in court tomorrow morning, I want you to bring Jamie to see me tonight at 7.
Monday morning at 10 a.m., Greg Barber appeared in the courtroom of Judge Paul Martinez, ironically the same judge who had arraigned Alan Crowley. Barber was with Marge Chapman, who looked dejected and frightened, and Jamie, who looked excited to be there. Greg had spent more than an hour speaking to Jamie and Marge the night before. Every instinct in his body told him that Jamie had not committed this crime. Those same instincts, however, told him that Alan Crowley had not committed the crime either. Barber spoke to the assistant prosecutor, Artie Shulman. He told him that he would object to the application for fingerprints, but he conceded that the judge would probably grant it. He indicated that he represented both Marge and Jamie,
and that no one should speak to them without his permission. During the brief hearing, Shulman put on the record the reasons for the application and the interview of Jamie Chapman. While Chapman's account admittedly was not entirely clear, it would, if true and accurate, exonerate Alan Crowley. It was obvious that the judge was taken aback by this new information. He ordered that Jamie submit to the taking of his fingerprints. Greg then gently explained to Jamie what would happen when he went downstairs, and that he would be there with him. Jamie and Marge quietly followed their lawyer as the detective walked them to the prosecutor's office on the second floor of the courthouse. Marge waited on a bench outside in the hallway as Greg and Jamie went in. Within 30 minutes of the end of the hearing, prosecutor Matthew Koenig was inundated with calls from the media demanding to know more details about Jamie Chapman, the new suspect in Carrie Dowling's murder. The angriest call he received was from Alan's attorney, Lester Parker.
You know, prosecutor, I recognize that you can't immediately share every single development in the case. Obviously, your investigation has a long way to go, but I have an innocent 18-year-old who is so depressed that his parents are worried he's going to harm himself. When you go into a public courtroom and admit to these developments, and I have to hear it from a member of the press, that's just not right, and you know it.
Koenig responded, Look, Lester, I took your call because you deserved an explanation. We were hoping that this would not be picked up by the press until after we got his fingerprints, and we see if it helps the investigation one way or the other. We have no obligation to call you unless we come to the conclusion that Alan didn't do it. And we are very far from making that determination. I'm going to end this call now. If anything significant develops, I will let you know.
And I'll let you know if my innocent client commits suicide while waiting for your call.
With Jamie in the car, Marge drove directly home from the hearing. They were in the door a few minutes when he said,
Mom! I'm hungry. I want Chinese food for lunch.
Marge was about to call to order it and have it delivered when she opened the refrigerator and saw they were out of Diet Coke.
Jamie, I'll get the Chinese food, and I have to stop at the store. I won't be long. Why don't you watch a movie while I'm gone?
Returning 20 minutes later, Marge drove up her block and was dismayed to see a news truck parked in front of her house. Jamie was on the lawn, smiling. A woman with a microphone was standing next to him. A camera was pointed at them. Marge turned into the driveway and slammed on the brakes. As she got out of the car, she heard Jamie saying,
And then I went swimming with Carrie.
Leave him alone, Marge shouted. Jamie, don't say anything. Get in the house.
Startled at his mother's tone, Jamie ran inside. With the cameraman struggling to keep up, the reporter hurried over to Marge.
Mrs. Chapman, would you like to comment on today's hearing in Hackensack?
No, I won't. I want you and that guy with the camera to get off my property right now,
Marge yelled as she opened her front door and slammed it behind her. Feeling a little better in the safety of her home, but frantic about what else Jamie might have said, Marge collapsed into her favorite chair.
How much more of this can I take?
She asked herself as she looked around for her purse. She needed a nitroglycerin tablet.
Mom!
Jamie yelled from upstairs in his room.
Am I gonna be on TV like Alan Crowley?
No, Jamie,
Marge said, even as she wondered if he would be.
Mom, I want to eat in my room. Can you bring up the Chinese food?
Marge realized that along with the Diet Coke and her purse, it was still in the car. She walked over and peeked out the window. The camera crew was gone. The coast was clear. She ran to her car. 64. Assistant Prosecutor Artie Shulman and Mike Wilson walked together into Prosecutor Matt Koenig's office. They informed him that a fingerprint on the golf club had been matched to Jamie Chapman.
He admitted picking it up and putting it on a chair by the pool,
Mike said.
But we also have Alan Crowley's prints on the weapon, isn't that right?
Yes, we do.
We know Alan lied, but later Chapman told us that he saw Crowley talk to the victim and leave the property before anything happened to her.
I understand Chapman is intellectually impaired. Do you believe the information he provided is credible?
Koenig asked. Mike sighed.
For the most part, yes.